from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Linda Bolton Howe joins us with stories of high strangeness, followed by conversations with Linda, our investigative reporter. But here's what's happening. More than 6 weeks after Flight 370 disappeared, Malaysia's prime minister says that his government is still not prepared to declare it and the 239 people on board lost. At some point in time, I would be, but right now I think I need to take into account the feelings of the next of kin, he said. He also announced that his government will release a preliminary report next week on the plane's disappearance. That report has already been submitted to the United Nations. What's so strange about all of this is several weeks ago, the Prime Minister and Malaysia Airlines basically said in text messages to relatives of the passengers that they assume beyond any reasonable doubt that the flight had been lost and that none of those on board survived. Now he will not say that. It just gets stranger. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned Ukraine against continuing its anti-separatist offensive after government troops killed five rebels and prompted Russia's military to begin new drills on the two nations' borders. That situation is truly going to heat up. Dinesh D'Souza, one of the Coast to Coast guests, says that his prosecution on campaign finance charges may be political retribution for his railing against President Obama. There is a, quote, reasonable and credible basis for concern that the defendant was targeted for felony prosecution in this case, specifically because of his consistently highly publicized criticism of President Obama, a lawyer for the author and filmmaker wrote some time ago. And also, of course, Dinesh is coming out with a new film called America. He's going to be our guest in June for a couple hours on Coast to Coast, but I thought we'd bring him in. He's one of the top young policymakers in the country, and I just want to say and check in to see how he's doing. Dinesh, it's a pleasure always having you on. I need to know if you're okay.
Hello, George. I'm doing just fine. I had the pleasure of being on your show. I think it's been a few years ago now, yeah. Talking about my book on life after death. So I'm very pleased to be back.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you in June. I know a lot's been going on. You've got some battles ahead, so the best to you there. You've got a film coming up called America, the movie. I trust that it's going to be very well received. What can you tell us about it?
I think so. I mean, I think a lot of Americans are in a funk about our country right now, and this is a patriotic film. It's a powerful film. The philosopher Edmund Burke once said, to love our country should be lovely. And that's what this film will do. It'll actually show what about America is so lovely.
All right, Dinesh, we'll talk to you in June, a full couple hours, lots to talk with you about then. Regular exercise may keep Alzheimer's at bay, even in those with genes who put them in the dementia danger zone, they call it. A study of men and women in their 60s, 70s, and 80s found that being active at least three times a week stopped the brain from shrinking. So there you go. Drinking more than three large glasses of wine can push people over a tipping point, meaning that they consume about 6,300 extra calories in the following 24 hours. That's a way to gain weight, isn't it? And an international research team, including a George Washington University professor, has discovered and named the earliest and most primitive pterodactyl, a group of flying reptiles that would go on to become the largest known flying creatures to have ever existed, that they flew high above the planet some 163 million years ago, longer than previously known. What else is up in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what's up this week?
Well, good evening, George, and thanks for having me on tonight. No pterodactyls to report, but a lot of really, really interesting reports. You may recall when I was on last week briefly, I was talking about a pulse of reports that I had just received Friday evening early from all up and down the I-5 corridor from as far north as Bellingham, Washington, down to Chico, California, and our trusty webmaster has just posted all of those reports to our website. So if anybody is interested in seeing some very interesting reports, I would recommend that they take a look at our website, ufocenter.com, and look at the latest reports there. There are a lot of really, really interesting ones, in my opinion. Most of all, some reports from Yakima, Washington. I've got to credit a young fellow who's a high school student there. As you've heard me lament many times in the past, when I'm usually talking to a high school student, it's a prank call of some sort. One of the greatest frustrations of this job is handling all those pranked reports.
Yes. But
this young gentleman from Yakima, Washington, very polite, he wrote an excellent report, and he actually captured some very high-quality video of the cluster of objects that he caught just as people on the I-5 corridor were reporting the same thing. So people can see that video on our website, again, ufocenter.com. A couple very interesting reports. Last Saturday, the 19th of April, a flight instructor and commercial pilot in Orlando, Florida, was just walking out of a restaurant, sober as a judge, because he had to fly that night, and he saw a cluster of lights streaking down out of the sky. He was just riveted to watching this thing. It suddenly went behind a near building. He thought it was an aircraft that was going to hit the ground at high speed and crash. Next thing he knew, it came from behind the building. It just climbed vertically and went straight up in the sky from his vantage point. People can read that report on our website from our homepage. Also, just two nights ago, Tuesday night, the 22nd of April, a gentleman out here not too far from where I live in eastern Washington was driving on a rural road out in the middle of a wheat field, and he saw some lights to the north. He thought they were a helicopter coming probably from the Canadian border. They patrol that Canadian border between Washington and Canada pretty routinely.
Mm-hmm.
And he continued to watch it. Suddenly, the hair on the back of his neck stood straight up. He realized he was not looking at a helicopter or any other kind of conventional aircraft of any sort that he'd ever seen. The object went right over his head. He said it looked like a main battle tank. No wings, a cluster of lights. Jeez. Right in the belly, and it scared the daylights out of him, as scared as somebody in eastern Washington ever gets at night out here, which probably isn't very scared at all. But this gentleman has had very responsible jobs for the last three decades of his life, probably an excellent witness. And to close it off, a couple of very interesting reports tonight, one from Queen Valley, Arizona. I think that's on the east side of Phoenix, if I'm not mistaken. People were actually stopped on the highway, according to one witness. They saw an object that looked like a flying X, the letter X, go right over their head. People were stopped watching this thing, which apparently stopped in the night sky and then suddenly streaked off and was gone. That report is not on our website yet, but we hope to have it there in the very near future. So lots going on, and if any of our listeners have seen UFOs in the recent past, we'd urge them to fill out a report form and send us a report, and we might be talking about that report in the near future.
Peter's website, ufocenter.com. Peter, thank you so much. A long-suppressed report prepared by the Department of Homeland Security for the Defense Department concludes that North Korea could deliver on its threats to destroy the United States with an electromagnetic pulse attack. The report remains blocked from release to the American public. A copy was obtained by Peter Vincent Pry from the sources within the DHS, which finds that North Korea could use its space launch vehicle to deliver a nuclear warhead as a satellite over the South Pole to attack the U.S. from the south. Pry is the executive director of the Congressional Advisory Task Force on National and Homeland Security, and he is our guest in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Recent attacks on transformer substations and other critical parts of the electric grid have just underscored one of America's most serious vulnerabilities. If the power goes off and stays off, our nation and the vast majority of you will cease to exist. It's a story we have been hammering at for years now, and it's good to know that Peter Pry is one of them that is on top of this. Of course, you know, we've talked with William Forstchen, his book, One Second After, and A Nation Forsaken, Michael Maloof as well. Peter has a couple books out called Electric Armageddon and Apocalypse Unknown. He is, of course, the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. That's a congressional advisory board dedicated to achieving protection of the United States. So it's glad that somebody there is starting to wake up to help us. And here's Peter on Coast to Coast. Peter, I've got to congratulate you and compliment you for being part of this to secure the grid, because I think it's a huge problem.
It is a huge problem, and we have reason to be even more concerned, since there's a, you know, sort of a backlash happening in Washington, led by NERC, which is the lobby for the electric power industry, to basically silence those who are trying to raise these issues. Just last week, there were congressional hearings, not focused on what we should do to protect the national electric grid. I mean, there should be a big question in everybody's minds about what is NERC doing mm-hmm. to protect the national electric grid, since the Metcalf incident that you alluded to happened a year ago.
Yeah.
And yet they're doing nothing. But what they have decided to do is complain to the Department of Energy about the FERC report that was leaked to the press that revealed that if just 9 transformer substations were attacked in a Metcalf-type way, it could put the whole nation into a protracted blackout lasting weeks or months. You'd think they would be more concerned and that their focus would be on getting the grid protected and not on shutting up the U.S. FERC analysts who did that study, and people like John Wellinghoff, who resigned his chairmanship at U.S. FERC, a rare thing for a Washington bureaucrat to do, and a laudable thing, because he considered it a high priority to break this story to the Wall Street Journal. We might never have known about it if Wellinghoff hadn't resigned and gone public with the story.
You know, I was just watching the story this week, Peter, of the young man who jumped a fence and got into the wheel well of a Hawaiian Airlines plane, and he flew to Hawaii. He could have died. I don't know why he didn't, being in that. But, I mean, he was able to do that. Nobody stopped him. And I look at where all the transformers are around this country, and I spend my time going between St. Louis and Los Angeles. And the only thing protecting them, the only thing, may be a 6 to 8 foot wall and then a little barbed wire type fence on the top of it. But that's it. There's nobody around there. It's pitch black. You're right. It is extremely vulnerable. And it just doesn't seem that anybody is doing anything about it. Tell me how you got involved with this congressional advisory board.
Well, I've spent my whole professional life working on weapons of mass destruction, nuclear strategy, that sort of thing, beginning when I was a young man at the CIA. And I was their senior analyst on nuclear weapons and strategy, and particularly EMP, which at the time, well, we couldn't talk about that. What the things we are going to talk about today were deeply classified back then, which is why EMP sounds new to people. The Department of Defense, the intelligence community, has known about it for 50 years, ever since the Starfish Prime test in 1962. But most of the details were deeply classified. That changed when I worked for the Congressional EMP Commission under Dr. William Graham, who is retired now to California. He had been President Reagan's science advisor and was the chairman of that commission, director of NASA. When he was a young man, he was one of the first U.S. Army scientists who investigated the EMP phenomena that went to Hawaii to look at the effects of the Starfish Prime test. Anyway, the commission, Graham, decided that we needed to declassify a lot of this. So for the first time, basically it's only since 2008 that that we've really been able to start talking about this in depth. So for the public, EMP is a new thing. I started the Congressional Advisory Board. The task force is an attempt to fill the vacuum that was left when the Congressional EMP Commission went away. Congressional commissions don't last a long period of time. This one was unusual. It lasted almost a decade. But typically, they only last about 18 months to 2 years. And they're not intended to be permanent institutions. This is such a large problem. And unusually, in the case of most congressional commissions, their recommendations are usually followed. You know, we have a national missile defense today because of the Rumsfeld Commission said we needed one, and they turned out to be right. You know, because North Korea does have nuclear weapons and missiles now that could threaten us. And we reformed the intelligence community based on the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. And we have a cyber command and offices of cybersecurity in the White House and down to the county level because of the recommendations of the Marsh Commission. Yet even though we've had two congressional commissions on EMP, the Congressional EMP Commission, and then it was followed by another commission that reexamined the problem, it's called the Strategic Posture Commission, and they came to exactly the same conclusion and made the same recommendations. Moreover, there's been a number of major U.S. government studies by the Department of Energy, the National Academy of Sciences, the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, all arriving at the same conclusion about that this is an existential threat. And by that I mean, you know, we concluded that given our current unpreparedness, 9 of 10 Americans could die within a year of a nuclear EMP attack or a natural EMP.
Or an X-flare from the sun, a big one, could do the same thing, couldn't it?
Well, we're thinking about a Carrington-class geomagnetic storm.
Right.
X-flare is a different kind of a phenomena that wouldn't likely have the kind of catastrophic consequences, you know, we're worried about. It'd be very disruptive of satellites and the like. But a geomagnetic storm on a Carrington scale, or like the 1921 railroad storm, which was one, take the 1921 railroad storm. I mean, that was only in one-tenth as powerful as Carrington. But the National Academy of Sciences estimated that if that happened today, it would cause a blackout lasting 4 to 10 years, and we might never recover from it.
Now, this would also be a planetary-wide disaster. It wouldn't just be us in terms of a natural event, correct?
With Carrington, that would be the case. The 1921 railroad storm would be like focused on a continent. You know, the railroad storm when it occurred in 21 was focused on North America. Even that recently, we weren't a heavily electrified country. That didn't happen until the Roosevelt administration.
You know, Kim Jong-un, I think he's nutty enough to do something like this.
Or clever enough. He has actually practiced it. People have seems to have forgotten it already, but it was just last February, March, and April that we went through our most serious ever nuclear crisis with North Korea, where they were threatening to make nuclear strikes on us. And they probably could have done it, you know, because they had just 3 months earlier, in December 2012, North Korea had orbited a satellite, was clearly imitating a secret weapon that the Soviets had designed back in the Cold War, called a fractional orbital bombardment system. It's where instead of launching a warhead on a ballistic trajectory like a normal ICBM, you launch it as a satellite. And if you do it this way, and as the North Koreans did and as the Soviets practiced during the Cold War, you can launch the missile away from the United States and put it on a south polar orbit. And it swings around the South Pole and comes up from the south. And we don't have any ballistic missile early warning radars or interceptors facing south. And that North Korean satellite, the KSM-3, mm-hmm. is the ideal altitude, you know, for doing an EMP attack that would take out the 48 contiguous United States if it were a nuclear warhead. Now, you heard mentioned the Metcalf incident on April 16th. This we don't know who did it.
Could have been several people, right?
Well, yes. In fact, the estimate is at least two, and perhaps as many as six. And the U.S. Navy SEALs, the people who trained the SEALs, looked at it and said this was a military commando operation. Yeah. This was highly professional.
It was a test.
Exactly. That's what John Wellinghoff describes it as a dry run, a practice run. Well, the day that happened, on April 16th, North Korea's KSM-3 satellite was over the Washington, D.C., New York City corridor in an ideal location to take out the Eastern Grid, which is their 75%. So we're wondering if this was part of a larger cyber warfare operation. It's not one of the things Jim Woolsey, former CIA director, has been trying to educate people on, is that in the military doctrines of Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, their version of cyber warfare, an all-out cyber warfare attack, would not be limited to computer viruses and bugs. and computer hacking. That is in our definition. Their doctrine includes things like Metcalf-type sabotage assault.
Exactly. Peter, stay with us. We're going to take this break. We're going to come right back and talk with you more about this, the possibilities of the grid going down and cyber attacks. And we'll take calls next. And our guest this hour, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, his books, Electric Armageddon, Apocalypse Unknown. He's the executive director of the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security. It is a congressional advisory board set up to protect us from a cyber attack, an attack on the grid, you name it. And we're going to come back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Peter Pry with us. Peter, this statistic, of course, if the power's off for a year, 9 out of 10 Americans would die. Those deaths would occur how? What would happen to them?
Well, you'd probably lose about 500,000 people immediately who, if we're talking about a nuclear EMP attack, from airliners crashing. You know, there's about 500,000 people overhead and 1,500 airliners at pretty much at any given moment. But most of the casualties, you know, on the order of hundreds of millions when you're talking about 9 of 10 Americans from starvation, disease, and societal collapse.
Gosh.
I mean, EMP is a high-tech way of killing people the old-fashioned way.
Yeah.
It's also a Sharia-compliant use of nuclear weapons under, under the Just War Doctrine that the Ayatollahs would follow in Iran, because they openly write about making EMP attacks against the United States in their military doctrine. And the idea here is that we're being destroyed by our own sins, our dependency on this high-tech society where we have basically elevated technology to the point of a god makes us so vulnerable. It's our Achilles heel, and it's the thing that ends up destroying us because of our corrupt materialist lifestyle. That's how they see it. If you think about it from a practical, you see the weapon in that case, it's Sharia compliant because the EMP doesn't directly kill anybody. You know, the electromagnetic pulse is like a super energetic radio wave.
It's the aftermath.
Harmlessly. Yeah, it's the aftermath, and it's your dependency on things like running water and modern food supply and storage and distribution systems and all of those technologies that make possible our complex modern society that makes us vulnerable.
Well, we had this record cold spell in the Midwest this winter, coldest in 20 years. The power, I know in the St. Louis area where I was at that time, I just left, but my son was there, went out for 2 hours, only 2 hours. And, you know, with the temperatures, you know, hovering around zero, people couldn't take it, Peter. They lost it. That's 2 hours. Imagine a year.
Oh, yeah. We had a small hurricane a few years ago pass through the St. Mary's County Peninsula, where I live, horse farm, and we lost the power for 2 weeks. And my wife almost divorced me at the end of that time. It's very hard to get on. I mean, there are simple things that you don't even think about, like the fact that you can't flush the toilet because there's no running water.
That's right.
In addition to not being able to get pure drinking water and the like. But the consequences, as soon as you turn the electricity out, I mean, if you think it through, you can't get gas for your car. There's no communications. Massive food spoilage because, there's only about 3 months' food to feed the whole country that's stored in these regional food warehouses that resupply grocery stores. And that depends on air conditioning systems, temperature-controlled systems, and the like. You know, there's not that much food. You know, only 10% of it is in, like, cans. And that would be very quickly exhausted. So, you know, that's where the concern about starvation comes in. We looked at what was the country able to support before we had electric grids and our modern technology. I mean, if you go back to 1914, for example, the country's population was 99 million. I mean, that's what you could support under 1914-type technology. Basically, 210 million Americans at least end up having to go away, because they wouldn't be sustainable. And on examining the casualty lists further, the casualty causations further, on the advice of a brilliant guy named Fritz Ehrmacht, who had been the chairman of the National Intelligence Council, he pointed out that even those 100 million that might be left over probably would not be able to survive because the country in 1914 was only one generation removed from pioneer stock.
That's
true. Everybody knew how to hunt and fish, and 75% of the population was still farmers. Today, less than 2% of the population feeds the other 98%, and people just don't have the survival skills anymore.
The danger of all of this, of course, on a 1 to 10, would be how high, the possibility?
Well, possibility of a Carrington event recurring is it's inevitable. It's definitely going to happen someday. Most scientists think that it will happen within our lives or the lives of our children, because it happens about once every century or so. And Carrington was 155 years ago.
And if the sun is pointed directly toward us in alignment, that's a big problem.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, we were narrowly missed by a Carrington class coronal mass ejection back in July 2012. You know, it missed us by 3 days. These things actually, that's one of the things we discovered as we went into this most recent solar maximum, which is a period when the sun puts out more of these coronal mass ejections.
Right.
And so the risk of a Carrington increases. The Carrington class coronal mass ejections happen all the time. We didn't know that before. We didn't know how rare they were, but they're quite common. It's just a question of luck. You know, we're basically playing Russian roulette with the sun. And the clock seems to be running up against the end game here in terms of when we're going to get hit. So sometime in the not-too-distant future, we'll probably experience Carrington class, the Jamaica-like superstorm. On the nuclear threat, the man-made EMP, I mean, just last April, as I had mentioned earlier, you know, North Korea was threatening to strike us with a nuclear missile. By Obama administration's own estimates, Iran is 2 months away from getting an atomic bomb. I personally think that that's a hopeful estimate. I think they've already got the bomb. And the reason they may not have used it is because of their own eschatological calculations about the return of the 12th Imam and all that. They're not a normal nation state. They're not looking for the bomb for geopolitical and geostrategic reasons. It's for religious reasons, and they have their own checklist. For all we know, I think it's entirely possible that a nuclear scud might be sitting on a freighter down in Venezuela, waiting for something to happen, like an attack on Iran.
Well, and how do we retaliate, Peter, when you really don't know who's doing it?
Well, you can't. You don't know who's doing it, because it could be terrorist groups. It could be North Korea, Iran. That's the concern about especially the scenario where you use an attack from a freighter. And you don't even need a missile, by the way. You could loft a weapon above 30 kilometers with a meteorological balloon. And that would be good enough if you got it over the eastern grid. You know, because
just
eastern grid, the only part of the, even if the western grid and the Texas grid remain, you know, 75% of our electricity comes from the eastern grid. And if we only lose that, we're basically goners, because we can't. But I don't want to be too much of a doom and gloom kind of guy here, because ultimately the EMP Commission report and our work on this was a good news story. You know, we've known for 50 years how to protect against this. There's really no excuse for the society to be vulnerable. You know, we could use Faraday cages and blocking devices and surge arresters. And it's not even expensive to protect.
And we should be doing that right now, Peter. Right now.
We should be doing it right now. And had the Grid Act passed back in 2010, when it was first introduced by liberal Democrats, by the way, Waxman and Mr. Markey. This is a nonpartisan thing. I mean, it's one of the few things on which conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats are united. But they had introduced the Grid Act. It was supported by conservatives in Congress as well. It passed the House unanimously. But Washington is so broken. You know, we've arrived at a place where I don't think the founders intended the situation that we have today, where because of the committee systems and special privileges, that a single member of the Senate or a single member of the House, if he's on the right committee, can basically thwart the will of a supermajority. In this case, it was the entire House of Representatives that was stopped by one senator who didn't want the GRID Act to pass. Had the GRID Act passed in 2010, we'd already be protected. You know, we estimated it would have taken about 3.5 years to protect the grid, moving at a leisurely pace. And, you know, that was, it's 2014 now, so that would have been more than 3.5 years to get it done. Unfortunately, we've been trying since 2010 to get a bill, the SHIELD Act, the GRID Act. You know, they're very similar bills. They're both have bipartisan support. You know, but the SHIELD Act and GRID have both been locked up in committee now on the House side, and we haven't been able to get the thing out on the floor so people can vote on it. Again, this is a situation, you know, where it's because of the way the committee system works, you know, that you can keep a bill bottled up. There is a lot of hope, though, on the legislative side. Recently, last year, my task force decided to take this to the states. The state public utility commissions have the legal authority to order the utilities. We don't have this authority at the federal level. That's the problem. You know, the GRID Act and the SHIELD Act are about giving these legal authorities to the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission so they can order the utilities to protect the grid. The electric grid is the only critical infrastructure that doesn't have, that basically still exists in the 19th century regulatory environment, you know, where there is no, where the Congress, the President, they can't be forced to do the right thing and to protect the grid. I'm a Tea Party Republican, and I don't believe in big government, by the way. But there is a legitimate role for government in critical national and homeland security issues, and this is one of them. I think all of us can agree we need a Federal Aviation Administration to have oversight over the airline industry, for example, you know, so that you can't fly airplanes when metal fatigue shows up in wings, and that you've got an objective, independent agency that can ground that plane or ground the fleet of planes if necessary, because hundreds of lives are at stake. Well, here we have a situation where hundreds of millions of lives are at stake, and yet the federal government has no power to protect the grid. Now, the state governments do have that power. Their public utilities commissions have that power. So just beginning last year, we've started going to the states to educate the state legislatures and ask them to, you know, take steps to protect their state grid. You know, even though a state's grid is usually part of a larger regional grid, you can island a state's grid by protecting the assets within the state. It doesn't change the way the grid operates within the state. The fences I refer to, you know, the Faraday cages and surge arresters and the like, they're passive. You know, they only come on when an EMP or a cyber bug or something like that is trying to attack the key nodes within the grid. Otherwise, it operates normally. And we've started to achieve success, very rapid success, given the little amount of time we've been working on it. Maine has passed the bill, LD-131. It was signed into law by the governor. Perfect. They're looking at protecting their grid now. Virginia, early this year, passed the bill, signed into law by the governor. They're moving forward, and Florida is moving forward.
Well, let's get the rest of the states. Peter, let's take a few calls here with you while we have some time. John in New York, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, John. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you tonight, George?
Good, John.
How are you, Peter?
Good.
Very good, thank you.
My question being is, now that we know that places like North Korea and others have the capability, what are we doing as far as countermanding that, as far as like a retaliation possible? And I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on the non-nuclear, other than electrical, countermeasures that we could throw back at them if necessary, and are we, how are we going to be able to protect ourselves from the non-nuclear one? Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Well, you know, Peter, if we do retaliate, it'll be devastating to them. But again, the problem is you don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah, and how do you retaliate is one of the questions that's always raised. We have our own just war type doctrine, which requires proportional response. And many would say it's not credible to threaten to, say, annihilate Pyongyang and destroy, you know, kill millions of North Korean civilians who are essentially innocent. Kim Jong-un would be hiding someplace in a bunker.
Sure.
We wouldn't even know where. In response to an EMP attack that doesn't immediately kill anybody, That's a very hard call. Would that be a credible threat? The commission did recommend that the United States make a matter of declaratory policy that we would regard an EMP attack as just like a regular nuclear attack on a city or something like that, as well it should be regarded, and so that at least we would have the declaratory policy that might help reinforce deterrence. But when you're dealing with states like North Korea and Iran, which are so unstable and so unpredictable, I mean, this guy is assassinating close relatives and doesn't think anything about starving to death hundreds of thousands of his own people. The idea that he's going to act rationally by our lights and that he's going to calculate things the way we hope he does, well, we've just been disappointed in that over and over again just by North Korea's recent behavior, you know, sinking an act of war when they sank a South Korean warship 2 years ago. And they've got a radio frequency cannon. It's a non-nuclear EMP weapon that they use. They were using it. They got it from the Russians, and they were using it to basically attack South Korean airliners and were sort of besieging Seoul, you know, by attacking the GPS systems on the airliners for a while. So they engage in warlike, irrational behavior all the time. And they also cannot be trusted to accurately calculate what we're doing. You know, they are really paranoid. They really do not trust us. And, you know, they could misconstrue some action by the United States as, well, here it is. The United States is finally going to attack us.
Yeah,
so we better EMP them.
Yep.
You know, so the threat of retaliation is no guarantee isn't much of a – I wouldn't want to bank my children's life on the idea that that would work really well against North Korea.
No, would I.
On the question about protecting against non-nuclear EMP weapons, he's referring to radio frequency weapons because you can make EMP. That's another serious threat. We did an experiment when I was on the terrorism subcommittee and House Armed Services Committee, you know, where we hired somebody, gave him a small budget and a couple of students to help him. And using only design information available on the Internet and working only with parts that could be purchased from Radio Shack, you know, we said, see if you can come up with a radio frequency weapon, a non-nuclear EMP weapon. And they built two of them in a year. And one of them was designed to fit inside a Volkswagen bus, and you could drive it down Wall Street. And the idea was you would fry out the Wall Street.
And it worked?
Yeah, it would work if you did that. We, of course, didn't test it on Wall Street, but we brought it to Aberdeen Proving Grounds and tested it there. Another one, second one, was disguised as a Xerox machine. And the idea there, this was before 9/11, before they tightened security at the Pentagon. The idea was to just mail it to the Pentagon mailroom, and it would sit in the Pentagon and fry the Pentagon defense computers. Now, these are localized in their effects, these EMPs. Still, you know, we've arrived at a place where technology has now enabled a criminal, a terrorist, a madman who has some knowledge of electronics to on his own pretty much.
And I think, Peter, that's going to be the next step. That's going to be the next kind of attack. We're with Peter Pry, his book, Electric Armageddon and Apocalypse Unknown. Peter, we need to keep you as a resource in the future. I'm afraid we're going to need your expertise. I'll be back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM.